Let's go.
Let's go.
Oh, no. Do you want to?
Sorry. I'll let you.
Next one.
I'm excited and I feel relaxed and I'm ready to party.
Don't say sorry. You don't need to do that. You don't need to apologize. It's a fucked up female habit. You don't need to be sorry for anything ever.
Can you guess what every woman's worst nightmare is?
I don't have rage issues!
I have nothing to prove to you.
When I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
I say when it comes to stardom and Lauren, there are no accidents.
Hi, Karen Peterson.
Hello and welcome to Citizen Dame, the podcast where we love automobiles.
We do.
I'm Karen Peterson, joined by Lauren Humphreys Brooks, who's definitely not having car trouble.
No, not at all. Not at all. So I don't know. I think it's what happens when you have a car in New York City and it's also an old car, and then also cars are just stupid. Cars are stupid.
I honestly, I love having the freedom of having a vehicle and being able to go wherever I want, whenever I want, but I hate having to drive. So,
yeah, there are a couple reasons why I got a car. And like a lot of people are like, you have a car in New York? Just like, yeah, I do. There are reasons for it. But not the least of them to do with my dog and having a dog and things like that. So I don't mind driving in New York now at this point, but it's a different kind of hassle than in like your normal rural area where I'm from.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, even here, it's not that bad because we're built for cars. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's annoying to drive to LA. It's annoying to drive in LA, but it's built for cars. So it's not that bad. You know, it's just annoying because there's a lot of traffic.
You know what New York City is not built for? Cars. Cars. Jesus fucking Christ. You don't know, man. If anyone who's ever tried to drive in like Williamsburg knows what I'm talking about. Or Chinatown. Try driving in Chinatown sometime.
I've seen it in movies.
It's like there, it is not made for vehicles or people, really, but definitely not vehicles.
So in the new Ghostbusters movie, there's a lot of reasons why it's a bad movie, but one of the things that was unintentionally hilarious was in the opening scene with the Spengler family. You have them chasing a ghost through the streets of somewhere in New York. I'm not sure where they're supposed to be, but they're driving the Ghostbuster car, like just careening down the street, and Paul Rudd makes a comment about, like, because McKenna Grace Phoebe, she wants to use the jump seat to go out and try to get this ghost. And he's like, you're not doing that in rush hour traffic. And the streets are empty. I'm like, this is not rush hour anywhere, let alone New York.
Rush hour. You could move in rush hour traffic in New York. Do you know when I've been trapped on like the West Side of West Side Highway in fucking rush hour trying to not wind up in the Holland Tunnel? Like, fucking A, man. Now I'm trying to remember the name of the film. I think it's called the Seven Ups. It's from the 1970s, and there's a car chase that runs through like the entire, I think it starts in the Bronx and it runs all the way through Manhattan. And it gets to the George Washington Bridge. And I think they wind up on the Palisades actually, but so they get to the George Washington Bridge and it's like, they're just like careening through, and I'm watching this going like, okay, like I know that the 70s, it was less populated, but no one can drive that quickly on the George Washington Bridge in the middle of the day. That is not how this works. And I asked my parents who did live in New York in the 70s, like, would this actually be possible? No, no way in hell. No way in hell. They're just like, they're driving around the things. It's like booming back and forth. Just like the George Washington Bridge must be like shut down or something, because there's no, that's not how it works.
Oh yeah, well, every day I do have a commute to my job. Oh hey, let's talk about jobs today.
Yay, jobs. Rush hour traffic.
Luckily, my commute is against traffic, so I don't usually have a lot either direction, which is very nice to go to my job. But and you don't have any commute at all.
I know, and it's about a 10-second commute from.
I was gonna
my
say, what's that traffic like trying to get into your from one room to the other?
Sometimes I, there is some traffic, and I like have to get my coworker to get out of the way and give him something to do, because otherwise he makes a lot of noise and like bothers me and shit. So it can be difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, today we are talking about some workplace comedies, specifically women in the workplace comedies. And I think this is going to be fun. So we're going to start off with the 1957 Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy movie Desk Set. And then we're going to go to 1980 for 9 to 5 and then 1988 for Working Girl. So that's what we're doing today. Hope you all are looking forward to it as much as we are. First, we're going to talk about, like I said, 1957 Desk Set with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. And this is basically it's about two people. One runs the research department at a television network. And that's Katharine Hepburn. And Spencer Tracy plays a guy who is trying to help automize or computerize. Automatize? I don't know.
Yeah, something like that.
Whatever the word is. He's trying to bring in a computer. So to help with the work. And of course, hijinks ensue because it's a 1950s comedy. But this was directed by Walter Lang and written by Nora Ephron's parents, Henry and Phoebe Ephron.
I was wondering if they were related. And initially I was just like, is that right? And it's like, yeah, apparently so.
Yep. That's her mom and dad. And honestly, I was like, oh yeah, I can totally see it. Watching this movie, I was like,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, there's definitely.
Yeah.
It's that kind of some of the classic rom-com setups, you know, misunderstandings and like disagreements that aren't really disagreements and a lot of workplace banter and things like that. Yeah. I really enjoy this film. I've seen it a couple of times and I think it's really interesting, not just in terms of the rom-com aspects, but just the, like you say, the workplace things and particularly Katharine Hepburn's relationship with her team in research.
Yeah. So this is the first time I had actually seen it. And I'm going to be really honest. I don't think I'd even heard of it until last week when you mentioned it. And so I had never seen this before. So it was my first time. And I really enjoyed the movie overall. I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought it was cute. I definitely thought there were some things about it that were very clever, but there were also some things that kind of bothered me too. And so I'm just going to get that out of the way and then we can just talk about the good stuff.
All right. Yeah.
So Katharine Hepburn, I was like, how old is she supposed to be? Because at the time this movie came out, she is 50 years old and she is very sophisticated and she's acting like a 22-year-old girl that's got this crush on Mike and I hope he takes me to the dance. And I was like, what is happening? This is ridiculous. And I know it was a different world for single women in the 50s, but it was just like, come on. So that part was a little bit like, just it felt like she was trying to play a younger character than she actually is. I didn't believe her in this role at all. That being said, I had fun with the movie anyway.
Well, so actually one of the things I really like about this is the fact that it's older people. Mm-hmm. And so like both Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, like you say, are visibly older. Like you can tell you can tell that Katharine Hepburn is like, you know, I probably would have guessed late 40s, early 50s, something like that. So it's about right. And same thing with Spencer Tracy. Like they both just like, okay, these are older people. And what I agree that there are some of those, like, I guess, rom-com beats where it's just where this woman has been basically being strung along by this guy.
Yeah.
For quite a long time. And it's implied that that's been happening for quite a long time.
7 years.
But one of the things that I actually like about that is that when we get into kind of the romance that begins developing between Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, it feels much more adult. than it would if they were being played by younger people. Just generally, like, same script, but just you have this more like mature attitude.
I completely agree with that. Totally agree. And I really like that as well. It's just this thing with, I'm sorry, I totally cut you off.
The other element is that I think that you're right in terms of, you know, the, oh, is he going to take me to the dance kind of thing? But I also thought that that made sense in terms of her age to a certain degree, because she's represented as very much this woman who's incredibly intelligent and but is socially inept in a lot of ways. Like, is not really like, she's stunted in a certain sense. And that's one of the things that I kind of like about it, is that he's treating her like, yeah, like that she's always going to be there. And the implication is that she always has been there, and she's reached a point where she's like, I don't want to just be the, you know, second thought.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I think that that works in terms of the general concept of her age. Maybe not like, oh, if this is a 50-year-old woman, but the way that that relationship is developed, I think it actually does work well. If at the same time, we're kind of like, yeah, she's acting much younger than she really should be. So that's my attitude.
I totally agree with what you're saying in terms of the character. I mean, I am a mid to late 40s woman myself, single, and have several friends who are too. And I definitely have friends in my circle that would behave like this, that do behave like this, where it's like, oh my gosh, I think he might like me. And I hope he'll ask me out or whatever, or being strung along for years. Like, I see this happening. My thing with it was specifically, I do not believe Katharine Hepburn would put up with that shit.
Well, yeah, I mean, she is, and like the way that she plays a lot of things, she's very sarcastic. She's very like, she's very kind of, what do you say, centered and elegant and everything. So yeah, I can see that. I can see that as well.
So that was my only thing, was just like, Katharine Hepburn, you would never. Like, you would have kicked this dude to the curb 6 months after you met him if he wasn't making a move.
Well, it's also, but he's played by Gig Young.
Yeah.
Like, of all, I mean, I'm sorry. Like, there are definitely times in films where I'm just like, you should have cast literally anyone else in certain parts. And I just like, Gig Young, a lot of the time in his roles, what he's playing is the basic white guy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, intended to be his role. But with this, yeah, it's a little bit like, boy, you got Katharine Hepburn and you're stringing her along like this. Like, you do not have enough game to do that, man. Like,
right.
You are not hot enough to pull this shit.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I just was, because I was trying to figure out how old he was too. Holy crap. I did not know how he died. Do you know about those?
Yeah, he was murdered, wasn't he?
No, he murdered his wife and then killed himself.
Yeah.
Holy crap. 3 weeks after they got married, he was 65 and she was 31. Well, that's that's a downer. Anyway, yeah, so fuck that guy. anyway, Spencer Tracy, though, this is another thing where it was like, again, I really like the movie. I fully enjoyed it. But again, with the Katharine Hepburn specific, like, I could see Joan Blondell doing stuff like this just because of the character that she's playing and the way that she plays it. But like when Spencer Tracy comes in and he's just poking around and stuff, and she's just kind of like not asking enough questions. like I just feel like she's someone who would have just been like, tell me what you're doing or get the fuck out.
See, it's one of those that maybe it's just playing differently for me, because I really liked that. I love that whole sequence where he's just like wandering around and all the women are like, what's happening? Like, and he's so kind of checked out half the time. And that's part of his character, is that he's very, again, these are two very smart people in their own ways, but are also very limited people at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so he's just like walking around doing measurements and not noticing the fact that these women are sitting there going like, hi, I'm like, who are you?
Why are you? Does he really not notice, or does he just not care? Because he knows what he's doing.
Well, I think that's more just that absent-minded professor kind of attitude of like, yes, he knows what he's doing, but he's not really paying attention to the social dynamics that are happening around him, right? He doesn't really introduce himself in like a clear way. He does, and he's been asked not to tell anybody exactly what he's up to, but there's also no explanation offered.
Yeah.
it's the same thing when the two of them have lunch together and he's like, oh, I'm gonna interview you, basically. And he starts asking all these questions. And after a while, she knows what he's up to. She figures it out. But there's no prefatory remarks. There's no like, okay, here's what we're doing, here's why we're doing this, anything. Yeah. Not even a lie. It's just like, all right, now I'm gonna ask you this random series of quiz questions, basically.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. That's where it's like, when he comes in first to the research office and the other three ladies are just like, what's he doing? I don't know. It's that I totally buy. It's when she comes in and doesn't immediately throw him out of her department if he doesn't explain who he is. That was my whole thing with this, was just, I just don't buy that Katharine Hepburn would have put up with that shit.
It's the Katharine Hepburn of it all that is, yes, is stopping you from.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, but, all right, that's fair.
But that all being said, accepting the movie as it is, I found it quite enjoyable and very sweet and very cute and funny. And the misunderstandings and the like, there are just some very funny moments about this. Like when the computer accidentally fires the entire building. That's great.
Well, one of the things I like about this is that, you know, first of all, it's very female centric. So you've got you've got a lot of focus. Yes, there's the romance that develops in the two of them, but there's also a lot of focus on Katharine Hepburn and the other three women who work for her. And sort of the inter-office dynamic of that, because there's this whole thing about the grapevine and secretaries. It's that the women connecting with each other.
Yeah.
And being the ones who kind of know everything that's going on and also are sometimes wrong about it, but they're also not being told certain things. So there's this whole like office dynamic that gets developed, particularly among the women and one other male character who is very queer coded.
Yes.
Even though he's married and got kids, but he's still very queer coded. and so it's got this like interesting kind of gender politics and sexual politics thing going on that is really fascinating to watch for like a late 50s film.
Yeah.
Late 50s workplace comedy. And then at the same time, you're bringing in these issues of automation and this whole thing of computers replacing or being able to think in the same way that humans do. And one of my favorite sections is kind of the climax of the film, where you've got this computer and you've basically got these women who think they're competing with the computer. And Katharine Hepburn begins reciting curfew shall not ring tonight. and like all of these other things, it's just this escalation, and it's funny, but it's also like, this is what humans are actually capable of.
Right. Yeah. And just everything that happens in that scene where as things are escalating and they ask a question that the computer that they think, oh, the computer's not going to be able to do this, but then it can. But then there's other things that it definitely can't do. And they think that they're, and this is something that it was interesting to see this movie that was set in the 1950s, because I remember this being a big concern and topic of conversation when I was a kid, like, oh, people in the workplace are going to be replaced by machines, which we do see that, but it doesn't completely eliminate the need for humans in jobs. You know, like there's still plenty of jobs that people need to do that machines can't. And so it was interesting to look at that. And I enjoyed how in that scene they see that they think that they're out the door, they think they're being replaced by this computer, but it's really about trying to make their lives easier. It's trying to help their work, not replace their work.
Yeah, and I think, and this is also a film that IBM gave a great deal of access for, so we got to remember that the IBM is kind of co-sponsoring the film a little bit. But I actually think that it deals with it in a very interesting way, and also in terms of, you know, some of the things that we've talked about currently with AI and stuff like this, and this whole idea of computers only being as smart as the information that is put into them by humans, and not being able to think in the same way that humans can, and the disinformation. And that's one of the things that I found quite, you know, entertaining about what happens at kind of the climax of like putting in information that then the computer is spitting out the wrong facts or spitting out information about something else because something wasn't spelled correctly, you know, that. So that's where the curfew shall not ring tonight comes mm-hmm. from. And it's similar, you know, in some of our experiences with Google, the like, you know, you'll Google something and be like, that is not the question that I have, right?
Right.
Because the way that the human mind actually functions and the information that humans actually want, which is, seems very straightforward for human beings, is just something that a machine can't necessarily comprehend. And so it's really interesting, I think, to watch a film like this, where you've got this massive computer that like has to be installed in like one floor of the office. And you're still talking about some of the same issues that we're currently talking about, you know, today.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that I find so fascinating as we watch more and more classic films. And I mean, a lot of times we're watching films I've seen before, but not always. But it's always a good reminder to me that people don't change and the world hasn't changed that much. Like, obviously, technology advances and those types of things change. But overall, we're still dealing with the same issues. And people did think of this shit like back then, you know, this isn't a brand new realization that, oh, AI is going to fuck shit up. It's like, no, this is something they've known for a really long time. And we have to be careful. And this is why machines can never actually replace people.
That's true. So there was something else I wanted to talk about really quickly when it comes to like the gender politics in this film, because there's the rom-com part, right?
Yes.
And particularly the scene where through a couple of different occurrences, Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn end up at her apartment in their robes, right? And then
I did quite enjoy that scene.
Gig Young comes in. And so there's this whole like loaded thing. And one of the things I really liked actually was the fact that they talk about before anything else happens. It's not like they're oblivious to this. They're just like, well, you know what everybody's going to think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and they even mentioned like the coworker who drove them home is like going to be like, oh, they went into the same apartment together. You know, that it's going to become a thing. And they're laughing about it.
Yeah.
And I really like the fact that this film, you know, and this is late 50s, so there's more likelihood that they're going to deal with it. I really like the fact that they actually dealt with that, and that the whole scene, which is very funny, is also very like, these are all grown-ups who should be having like an actual conversation about this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I really like that she has her own place. And that's a consideration when she and Mike are talking about their future, when he finally is starting to realize that, oh, hey, I actually don't want her to like, I actually want to do something with this. And she's like, wait, but I can't just like up and leave, you know? And I like that, but also that scene specifically, the rainstorm, they're at her apartment and Mike shows up. I love This is one thing that did feel very true to Katharine Hepburn for me. I love that she didn't immediately try to explain herself and comfort him in like, no, nothing's happening. This is what's going on. Like, I love that that's not her immediate reaction, is to try to like grovel and explain it and make him understand that nothing's going on, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And there's the way that scene is blocked too, with the two men sitting on opposite sides of the table and her in the middle. And she's just like, and she aggressively begins eating like her dessert. She's just like, I'm just going to eat the dessert. I don't even care. The hell with both of you.
Yeah. And that felt very like, yes. Yes. I like that.
It's very clever. And the Christmas party sequence is, mm-hmm. I think, very, very funny. But also, again, it you know, getting to the women in the workplace kind of thing, the interplay between her and Joan Blondell.
Yes.
And the way that they're like kind of joking, but also, you know, kind of riffing off of each other. They're getting progressively drunk. They begin kind of quizzing the Spencer Tracy character. There's this female camaraderie, I think, that develops throughout the film, where you have these women who have known each other and have worked together for a very long time, and they're friends, and they understand one another, and they play well off of each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I really do enjoy that scene. I had some comments about how funny it was that Katharine Hepburn just absolutely could not convince me that she was drunk. Like, it's actually pretty terrible drunk acting, but I thought that was endearing. That was not me going like, wow, this actor sucks in acting. You know, it was like,
I don't know. No. I've been drunk like that before.
I've seen people be really silly, but it just was very like, this is not... Like, it felt very much like someone pretending, like trying their best to pretend to be drunk and not doing it very well. And I actually found that really cute and funny that, like, amazing four times, like, she's got the record for most Academy Award wins for an actress. And she could not. I loved that. I actually, like, truly, truly, I thought that was great. But that whole scene, I really enjoy. I think that's one of the things that makes this movie such a fun movie and such a well thought out, well written movie, is that you have all of these series of escalations. So there's multiple scenes where things start one way and then they just escalate to a crescendo. And I think that Christmas party scene is another one. And yeah, and I totally agree with you. I love seeing the way that Hepburn and Blondell play off of each other too. I think it's a great moment for Joan Blondell, who for a lot of the movie is kind of there in the background. She's in it a lot, but she doesn't really get a ton to do, but that's kind of like one of her scenes. And yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yes, definitely.
Any other thoughts about Desk Set?
No, it's a fun, it's a very fun film. I suggested it because I think it's a really interesting, I think it's like, especially in comparison to the other two films we were talking about, it's an interesting kind of insight into sort of corporate culture and the way that corporate culture was represented on screen in the 1950s, and particularly feeding all of that through a female lens, where these are all very intelligent, capable women. None of these women are like it's a rom-com, but at the same time, the whole goal is not solely like to get married and leave your job.
Right.
And I think, again, that feeds back into what we were saying earlier about the age of the characters, that these are much more centered people. Definitely Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, they're much more, they're stunted in some ways, but they're also centered in other ways. And it's just like, no, whatever is going to happen, it has to be a mature decision, basically.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Well, that's going to bring us to 1980 and 9 to 5. This was directed by Colin Higgins and stars Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Dolly Parton as three women who work for I love that the plot description on IMDb is three female employees of a sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot find a way to turn the tables on it. And so this is this was nominated for one Oscar for the song 9 to 5, which, by the way, I just heard this yesterday. I think yesterday. Have you seen the collaboration between Dolly Parton and Pitbull?
I have not. No.
They do this song together and it is amazing.
I'll have to check it out.
I'm going to send it to you. It's all right, incredible. Awesome. Yeah. Anyway, Lauren, what are your thoughts on 9 to 5?
I love this movie so much. I think that this was, in fact, when we talked about doing this, we're just like, so we're going to do 9 to 5. That was the first thing that either one of us said. the whole point actually was to do 9 to 5 for this episode.
Pretty much.
Yeah, it's just, it's funny. It's so charming. I love, like, and a lot of people talk about this, the three women together are just so fantastic because they're all playing very different roles, and just riff off of each other incredibly well. You believe that these women would become friends. You believe that they would want to like hang out together, and you believe that they would like start plotting to get revenge on their boss together. It all works so incredibly well. It is so funny. I love Jane Fonda sort of halfway playing against type as this sort of staid housewife, stay at home mom kind of character who gradually comes into her own and also does things like, oh, I've never smoked marijuana. It's like, yes, no, Jane, that is a incredible lie. You know, oh, I can't, I've never been high before. Like all of that shit. It's just very funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Like all of them are having such a great time and they bounce off of each other well. And I do think that like Dabney Coleman also, you know, should be included in all of that because he is a great asshole. And has so many variations of assholery in this film.
It's so true. So there are so many things that I love about 9 to 5, all the things that you just said, but I also really have to include the way that women work in environments like this and how everyone kind of finds their own way to cope and to survive and to deal with it. And so you've got these three ladies. Dora Lee is Dolly Parton. She is Frank's secretary, Dabney Coleman's secretary, that he is trying to chase around the desk and she just isn't having it. But everybody assumes that he's having an affair with his secretary, so nobody will talk to her. Everybody just like shuns her just because of it. And she doesn't know that that's why nobody will talk to her until, you know, eventually she finds out that's what everyone thinks. And then you've got Violet, which is Lily Tomlin, who she's been working her ass off, and even like people who she trained, men that she trained that have been at the company much less time than her, have leapfrogged over her. And she even has a line about how she's got the backache to prove it, that she's being used as the jumping pad for all these men. And even though she's the one with all the good ideas. And then you've got Judy, which is Jane Fonda, who's brand new to the company, who is just trying to figure out this culture. And she really hasn't had a job before. She's just recently gotten divorced and now she just has to go and survive and take care of herself. And she's just trying to figure that out. So you've got these three women, but then you also have Roz, who is played by Elizabeth Wilson. And she is sort of Frank's right-hand woman. And she's the woman who supports the patriarchy. She's the woman who makes this dude, she like worships him, and she makes it possible for him to get away with all the shit that he does all the time. So I really enjoy seeing that dynamic, and just how true it feels. Like obviously this is satirical and it's exaggerated, but these personality types, I've worked in the corporate world and it feels so true to the experiences that I've seen and the people that I've seen in that life, you know?
Yeah. Like it's, and just in terms of the way that women actually relate to each other within, not just within the workplace, but just generally, it's very true to life. It feels very true to life. And also you say the misunderstandings. I love the way that they handle Dolly Parton's character because she's Dolly Parton, you know, she's blonde, she's got big breasts. She's like, and everybody kind of treats her as, oh, she's the dumb secretary who's having an affair with her boss. And then she finds out about it. She's just like, what?
Mm-hmm.
And it actually examines the sexism there, the sexism among women, right? The attitude that they're taking towards her because of what they're assuming about her. And meanwhile, she's like in love with her husband. She's totally like faithful. She's not, this is just the person that she is basically.
Mm-hmm.
And she is very smart and she is very capable. And we see more of that as the film goes on as well, because when the women get some power, they begin changing the corporate culture. And it, what happens is that things get better, that actually having this kind of collaborative element and these collaborative relationships make things better for everybody involved within the corporation.
Right.
And it's very cleverly done, and it's without, you know, being like, oh, we're going to burn down the building or anything like that. But there is that sense of like, it doesn't have to be like this kind of thing. We can actually make life better for everybody and everyone will be more productive.
Yeah. I'm going to use this opportunity to toot my own horn a little bit because I am a boss. Like I have a lot of employees that report to me and I'm just going to say I'm a really good boss. Like I'm really good at it. And I feel funny like talking about myself this way, but I have to a little bit because it's true. And like watching this movie, I was thinking about it, like the changes that they make where they allow flexible work schedules and they set up a daycare and they, you know, all these things that they do. I was just thinking about how I've been in the same department at this. I don't work in the corporate world, but I work at a school, which is a whole other crazy animal. Like if you've seen the show Community, you have an idea of what my job is like. But anyway, so yeah, I remember when Community came out and like my union was sending out emails, don't support this show. It's going to perpetuate negative stereotypes. And I was like, you mean the show that's completely accurate to my experience?
Just say, negative stereotypes. Maybe. I mean, you know, it might be.
Yeah. Anyway, but no, so I've been in the same department at the same school for 17 years. And over that time, there've been a lot of changes in the structure. A lot of people have come and gone. And it's just in the last like 5 years that I've actually been able to be in charge, basically. And we used to have so many problems with like really high turnover and constant schedule changes and constantly, you know, like people missing, calling out, stuff like that. And people would come in and they didn't really talk to each other. And over the last 5 years, my colleague and I, we have just worked really hard to change that. And now we can't get people to leave. we have tutors and they start when they're students at our school, but they're able to continue working even after they transfer. And sometimes they are trying to make transfer decisions like, oh, well, if I go to the school that's close, I can keep working here. And we're like, but the school that's close is not as good as the other one you got into. Go away. You know, and so we've really worked hard to build that culture of like, we've made it fun. We've made it where, you know, we have games and they're allowed to have food. They didn't used to be allowed to eat in the center, you know? And these are college students. They're coming from class. They're starving. You know, it's like just even little things like that, that we've completely shifted, and it really makes such a difference. And so I loved seeing this depicted in 9 to 5, where when the women have have tied up their boss literally, and he's not in charge, and they get to make all the decisions and do whatever they want under his name, so everybody thinks this is coming from him. They really just run with it, and they blow up the corporate structure. And I think this is my point, why I wanted to brag about myself for a minute. I think this is the point, is that like so much of the corporate world that's and education too, that's been run by men for so long. They have these very specific, very strict ways of doing things that just don't work with humans, especially when you have such a diverse pool of people now in the workforce, and everybody has different ideas and different desires of what the job should be. And you have to find ways to blend all that together. And back in 1980, they got it. Colin Higgins got it. And he, you know, they did such a great job of showing that, and how much more positive the workplace can be for everybody. If we just relax and not be so strict and boring.
Well, and again, I think a lot of it does come back to this collaboration. So you've got this kind of alpha male mentality, right, that is within the corporate world. And that's sort of the way everything is operating. The guy at the top who controls everybody and kind of acts with an iron fist and everything. And one of the things I find quite funny is that at one point, you know, he uses the football team metaphor, right? Mm-hmm. Just like, girls should have been able to play football because then you'd understand.
And you don't know teamwork because of it.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that you go, like, it's like, actually, But football is collaborative. Like, yeah, you've got the quarterback who's kind of in charge to a certain degree, but everybody has to be able to do their parts and everybody has to communicate with everyone else. No one person is the star, right? Mm-hmm. That's the whole point of a team sport, is that when you are on a team, everyone operates at the same time. And if one element of that begins to fall apart, the team falls apart.
Right.
And that's actually what the women wind up doing. So it stops being this one guy at the top who's controlling everybody and making everybody else unhappy, and becomes this like collaborative, like, okay, what do people need? Well, here are the things that the Jane Fonda character brings in, here are the things that Dora Lee brings in, et cetera. And then we're going to figure out how to implement that so that it works within this culture. And that's what's really, I think, very cool about this. You do have to say that the screenplay was written by Colin Higgins and Patricia Resnick, and the story was by Patricia Resnick. So there's definitely a lot of femaleness being filtered in through all of this. And I do think that one of the things that some films don't always address when it comes to the culture of women and the way that women relate to each other is that there is this attitude more of collaboration. We all have to be able to do our jobs versus one person is in charge and tells everybody else what to do.
Right. Yeah. This movie is just also really funny.
It
and,
is.
And I love the way that these three actresses play together, not just play off of each other, but play together. And like, for example, in the scene, this is before they ever kidnap Frank, but in the scene where they get high on Violet's son's marijuana, which I love the relationship that she has with her son, too. And like, she's a widow and she's a single mom of what, four boys. We only see her with one of her kids, really. But you get that sense that she's an awesome person that you'd want to be around, and like a great mom and stuff. And anyway, but when they sit around, they get high and they imagine what they would love to do to Frank to really teach him a lesson. And one of the things that I enjoy so much about this is Judy specifically. So you've got Dora Lee, who she's literally being sexually harassed. And then you've got, and also like, he's telling people that he's doing things with her that are not happening. And then you've got Violet, who has been skipped over for promotion after promotion, including a brand new one that's just happened. And then you've got Judy, who's just mad because he sucks. Like, nothing has specifically happened to her, but she's seeing what he's doing to other women. Yeah. And she's just like, nope, that dude needs to go down. And I love that. Like, she's just like, I'm ready to do this, you know? And it does, like, and that's the thing I love about the solidarity of women. It's like, if something happens to one of my friends, it happened to me and I'm going to take care of it too, you know?
Well, and it's interesting because I think Jane Fonda actually described this as being a labor film, that this is very much like about the workers, right? And again, and it goes back to that collaboration and the fact that, you know, within that corporate culture, the women are very often the workers, yeah. Particularly in this time period, that it's, you know, and certainly the way that it's represented in 9 to 5, you've got this guy who's at the top and then all of these women who are the ones that are doing the actual work.
Mm-hmm.
And are the ones with all of the good ideas and the ones that are really keeping things running, but the guy is taking all of the credit. And that's where the toxicity winds up coming in, and that's why it becomes problematic, et cetera. And then, you know, these three women are kind of like, through a series of mishaps, really, they don't totally set out that way, but it gradually becomes like, well, we're just going to have to kidnap him.
Which, I mean, it makes sense, like in the context of the story, it makes sense how that progression would happen. So like, Violet thinks she murdered him and then it turned out he's not murdered. Anyway, but I love that they keep him captive in his own house and they come up with things to do, like sending his wife. Well, his wife is away on this trip that he was supposed to go on, but he didn't go on. And his wife, poor Missy. Marion Mercer, man, that poor woman. She did not know who she was married to.
No.
And then you've got, they have to take care of Roz because Roz asks way too many questions, but she's also willing to do anything Mr. Hart asks. So, so I love that they, I love how much they have to think through all the details of like what they need to make this work and how they know that they're about to get him for some really shady stuff, you know, and if they can just, stick together and just hold out. And it's what, like 4 weeks or so that this whole thing is taking place, and the way they're completely able to shift the entire environment of the office so much that it ends up getting their boss a promotion.
Well, what's so funny about that as well is when you begin to realize just like nobody misses him,
right?
Like no one, so he's not seen, literally he's not seen anyone for 4 weeks, and they are running everything, and no one actually misses his presence like a person. And I really like that commentary as well, as saying like this is not an essential role. Basically, these three women who are all in, you know, in subordinate roles are really the ones that are running everything, and the fact is that they always have. They just haven't had the power to actually get to say what they want to do and be able to do it. I do also really like, and it's, you know, it's not PC anymore particularly, but I really like Dolly Parton's fantasy of like how she's going to get revenge on him. Uh-huh. The whole thing with like them flipping the script for like what sexual harassment looks like and everything. It is funny. Like it's just funny. And the fact that it's a fantasy, it's represented as a fantasy. It's like, oh, I really wish I could just give him a taste of his own medicine, because man, you feel like shit when this happens.
Yeah, well, and it makes such a good point, because, you know, for how many decades have we heard, oh, that's just how, you know, that's just how men are. It's we don't mean anything by it. It's fine. But when you see a woman doing that to a man, you can see how ridiculous it is. You know, like men need that visual of like how stupid you look treating women like that, and how insulting and degrading it is. Like it's actually a very smart visual.
Yeah, like all of her commentary on his clothing, like, you know, how I'm so distracted by you, you know, making him bend over and pick things up, all that sort of thing. It's very clever. It's very funny, and given the, you know, we've seen the way that she's treated, and the fact that it's Dolly Parton who has her own, you know, persona, bring her own persona to it. It's very, very well done and quite satisfying as well.
Yeah. And by the way, I do have to also recognize, I talked about Colin Higgins, who was the director and co-writer, but we also have to recognize this was co-written by Patricia Resnick. So I think that's part of why it gets things so right, is because when women are involved in telling stories about women, good things happen.
And it's also produced by Jane Fonda. She kind of brought the whole idea to fruition. So she's definitely got her own perspective, as does, I would imagine, that also Lily Tomlin and Dolly Parton, you know, contributed, not necessarily writing or anything like that, but were very much present in terms of the development of their characters.
Definitely. Yep. Any other thoughts about 9 to 5, which, by the way, that song is still so catchy.
I've been singing that song like, I've been alternating between two songs actually because of the films that we've been watching. I've been singing that song for a week.
Is there another song that has also been in your mind a lot this week?
Yes, Working Girl, and not the song by Carly Simon that, you know, features throughout the entire film of Working Girl, but the song from Bob's Burgers, Work Hard or Die Trying Girl.
From season 5, episode 1.
Which, if anyone has not seen that episode, please go watch it. Like, even if you're not into Bob's Burgers per se, just go watch that episode, because it is very funny, and it ends with this massive musical that is a mashup of Die Hard and Working Girl.
It's so funny.
And it's so hilarious. But like, literally every time I see the title of Working Girl, I'm like, I'm a working girl, a working, working girl. I'm a girl who's working.
Oh, yes. So we're going to talk about Working Girl now, which is from 1988. does feature an original song that won the Academy Award for Best Original Song, Let the River Run by Carly Simon. It was also nominated for Best Picture and Director and Lead Actress, Supporting Actress, and Supporting Actress. Oh, yeah, that's right. Joan Cusack and Sigourney Weaver were both nominated for that. Anyway,
wow.
Yeah, so Working Girl, directed by Mike Nichols, written by Kevin Wade, and stars Melanie Griffith, Harrison Ford, Sigourney Weaver, Joan Cusack, Alec Baldwin. I completely forgot about Kevin Spacey being in this, but luckily he's only in it for like one scene. Yeah, and anyway, so basically Melanie Griffith plays a secretary whose idea gets stolen by her boss, like a really good idea. And she's trying to learn and move up in the corporate world and like really make a name for herself. So when this happens, she realizes she needs to do something about it. And so she does. So what are your thoughts on Working Girl?
She does it very cleverly too. I enjoy this film a lot. One of the things that I really liked about it that I talked with you about on Slack is the kind of, there's a lot of role reversals that are going on. And particularly the fact that Tess McGill is our main character. She's the protagonist. But she's playing a role that very often in earlier films went to men. This kind of like trying to move up in the corporate world, discovering that, you know, her boss is stealing from her, all of that sort of thing. And that kind of runs throughout the entire narrative of her playing what might have been a male part, including the kind of trophy characters that were played by Harrison Ford. And I really like the fact that those roles get kind of muddled together a little bit, and we get to see like Tess getting the guy, literally, like she wins the guy. She you know, and it's because she's smart and she's capable, and she kind of gives the lie to a lot of the things that are said about her. And so it's a very smart kind of playing with these roles. And you even get scenes like where Harrison Ford is stripping off his shirt and all of the women, and you can see like the women in his office behind him turning to watch him do this and then applauding him. And like, it's very clever, and it's these very like little interesting kind of moments where things get flipped a little bit. And we kind of are seeing everything from this much more feminine perspective and the perspective of the female characters.
Yeah. I love Melanie Griffith in this movie as Tess. I think it's, first of all, it's a great performance, but it's also such a great character because she plays this woman who's so frequently and easily underestimated. You know, she has kind of this very particular voice, and she wears clothes that are not sophisticated, and she has this loser boyfriend, and you know, like, just, there's just so many things about her that it makes it easy for people to just dismiss how smart she is. She doesn't have a business degree from Harvard. She's going to night classes, and so people don't know what she's capable of, and so it makes it not that it makes it easier, because her journey is not easy, but it gives her kind of these openings to slip in and just surprise people and catch them off guard. And also it kind of makes her a little bit less inhibited, because she's not mired in what is respectable or what is acceptable. She's just like, you know what? I need to talk to this guy. Shoot, I'm going to go crash his daughter's wedding and talk to him. You know, like, she's just willing to take those risks. And it's such a great character. I love her so much.
Yeah, and she makes a very clear point at the end that, like, there is no other way for her to get ahead, basically. Mm-hmm. If she plays, so, and we see her a little bit at the beginning kind of trying to play by the rules, trying to go through these programs, and she keeps on being blocked, right? Because, oh, you're you're competing with the Harvard grads and stuff like that. And also because she's a woman, and that's the undercurrent of all of it.
Yeah.
So it's not just that she is undereducated as far as they're concerned, but she's also female.
Yeah.
And so, you know, her boss basically pimps her out at one point. And she recognizes as the film goes on that the only way she's going to succeed is by not playing by those rules. And in a certain sense, playing, you know, in the way that particularly male bosses eventually wind up admiring. And that's one of the things that kind of gets threaded throughout the entire story, is that she's doing the things that we would expect from a male character. And she becomes very admirable because of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
To the people around her. And yeah, she's smart. She's very intuitive. Like there's this whole conversation of like, where did you get the idea originally? And she kind of is able to go through it and say like, this is how I, you know, came to this conclusion. And it isn't just like her knowledge of the corporate world and of Wall Street, et cetera. It's also about her knowledge of culture. Mm-hmm. And there's that thing that gets folded in of like, and I think we see that throughout all three of these films, actually, is there's a certain stereotype about what female intelligence is. Right. And in these particular films, that's that intuitiveness and that understanding of, you know, reading magazines and things like that. And actually being able to absorb that and saying like, you know, this is where these women's strengths actually lie, that the men just like don't pay attention to because they're so trapped in this very hierarchical structure where there are certain things that are just not useful and certain things that are. And she's not.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Like she gets mocked at one point for reading People in page 6, but mm-hmm. that's part of what, like, that understanding, it's not just, oh, I'm reading the gossip rags. It's like that level of understanding of psychology, of a different aspect of the business world is what ultimately helps her convince everybody that she does know what she's doing and that she's got a good head for this and that she's got a perspective that she can bring that no one else has. And she needs that. Like, they need her fresh perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly. Ultimately that gets recognized. Let's talk about Sigourney Weaver.
Who plays such a good bitch.
Oh my gosh, she, like, really does.
She really does. She is one of the least likable characters on screen at any given moment. I'm like, again, you know, it's like Dabney Coleman in 9 to 5, just like, I just love to hate you. Like, I hate you so much and I enjoy that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love how, like, I don't know if, and I've seen this movie a bunch of times, so I don't know at what point Tess really started to question her boss. If it's not until she actually sees that she's been lied to and stolen from, or if she kind of had, I feel like she probably had a sense not to trust her. Pretty early on, but for us it's like that first introduction when Tess gets assigned to Catherine's office and she goes up there and Catherine's like, oh yeah, you know, it's all about trust and we're gonna take care of each other, and she really thinks that, you know, I've got the mentor that I need, this is finally, I'm working for a woman, so she feels safety in that insecurity, and like, this woman, she got there, and so she's going to help me get there too. And we can see kind of pretty quickly that no, it's very much, she's been playing a very different game, and that's part of why she's gotten where she is, because she kind of does play like the men do. But yeah, she's so poisonous, and she's so good at looking like she's not, like, she really camouflages that, but in a way where it's like, we know, but we also don't know. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, no, exactly. I think that that whole element of it being a woman, right? And there's this whole thing of, you know, Tess being like, well, she's going to help me because we're women, like, mm-hmm. we're going to help each other, right? And then of course it becomes clearer and clearer that she's behaving, as you say, in the kind of male, the patriarchal corporate way. And I think that it's very clever of the film, because it also is about class. There's this whole representation of, like, you know, Tess is from Staten Island. She's got a heavy accent. Like, she dresses in a particular way, all of that. There's definitely this attitude of like, she is of a lower class than Catherine, who is of the upper class. Right. And there's this whole conversation about like sorority sisters, and so Catherine has learned her entire life to play the game, and she's playing a game in a very female way that is also very patriarchal at the same time. And it's a good example of how female bosses, et cetera, can reinforce the patriarchy. and can kind of reinforce this incredibly toxic corporate culture that keeps people like Tess down.
Right.
In a really interesting way, that's in a contrast to what we see in 9 to 5, which is all about these like women coming together in this collaborative element of femaleness, right?
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting balance, I think, that gets struck when you actually look at the two films together. And they're 8 years apart, and very different stories and everything. But it's interesting to really consider that Catherine's femininity is very important, because it's weaponized.
Mm-hmm.
She weaponizes her femaleness, and we see it over and over again in the way that she relates to the men, and in also the way that she relates to Tess, and that kind of faux pleasantness, that faux kindness, that like, oh, you can trust me, we're in this together. And it's like, but you're not, don't trust her. And so I think that it's very subtly done, and it's very cleverly done.
Mm-hmm.
and ultimately the person that she is able to trust and that who is in it with her is Jack, who is actually a nice person and an ethical person who really does like trust her and believe in her.
Right. Which is an interesting dynamic too, because he's fully trusting in her, but she's lying to him. And what she's lying about is not anything that is her skills. It's just kind of her current station, I guess, basically. Like, she makes it seem like she's already more important than she is. But because that's what she has to do in order for anybody to listen to her. And she even makes that point to him when he finally finds out the truth of like, if I was just a secretary, we would never have had that conversation. You would have tried to sleep with me and that would have been it. And he mm-hmm. has to kind of like, he has to think about that and like kind of, yeah, she's not wrong. But because she's willing to take that risk and present herself as someone else, in a different position than she is, he's able to trust who she really truly is.
Mm-hmm. And to advocate for her, and to also use the power, what power he has, to kind of be like, no, you have to listen to her. You have to be like, I'm with her, basically.
Yeah. Well, and it makes it that much stronger. When he does get to that point and they're like, why should we listen to her? And he says, because I believe her. And it's like, he can say that even though she has been lying to him about something, but he understands that she hasn't been lying to him about the most important thing, which is how smart she actually is. And what a good head for this business she actually has.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just fun together.
They're just fun together. Harrison Ford is great. I do like the way that they handle the whole thing with her taking, like, she takes a drug and, like, passes out. And the poor guy has to carry her up, like, 3 flights of stairs. And it's just like, and then it turns out, like, and you're just like, oh, this could go bad in so many different ways. Just like, but it turns out he's actually, like, just a decent man. Mm-hmm. Like, he's a decent, ethical man.
Yep. Yeah. And he's cute.
And he's as they say in Bob's Burgers, it's medium young Harrison Ford.
Yes. And he's such a good contrast to Alec Baldwin, who's just the worst.
He's just the worst. He plays the worst character. He's so gross. You're like, ew, just go away.
Yeah. Like, oh, Tess, darling, you can do so much better. Get away from this guy. Oh, man. Any other thoughts about Working Girl?
Well, not to spoil the ending for everybody, but there's an element of the ending that I really like, which is that this indication that Tess is herself going to help change the culture.
Yes.
That she's not, she's not going to repeat what Catherine had done to her. She's actually going to listen to her secretaries, listen to her assistants, listen to the people around her, and listen and give, kind of hold the door open for other women. And mm-hmm. I think that's one of the really positive things that this film represents, is that there are toxic elements of female culture, and there are the women who are invested in patriarchy and who will defend patriarchy and who try to kind of work within it in order to succeed on their own. And then there are the women who are actually going to hold the door open for others. And that's what Tess becomes. And we kind of expect her to be that, but I really like that the film reinforces that. It isn't just her winning. It's her winning and being able to say to the woman that come behind her, I'm going to help you in a way that I wasn't helped.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's two things that are kind of working into that moment, because first of all, I don't believe Catherine's ever been a secretary. So she kind of worked her way into those positions without starting at the bottom, where Tess has had to work from the very bottom up to where she's at. And so you've got that. And then you also have the fact that she was completely screwed over by multiple bosses, including a woman that she really was hoping would be her mentor. And so she's carrying that experience and determined that she's not going to make those same mistakes. She's not going to make those same choices. She is a totally different person. And yeah, she absolutely, not only with her own secretary, but with other, you get the sense that she's going, like, they're going to do amazing things together. It's not just they're going to help her do amazing things. Like, they're all going to, she's really truly going to do what Catherine claimed she was about in the beginning, which is like, we're all in this together.
Yeah. And it's that very important element that, you know, there are multiple reactions that women have to becoming successful. And one of them is sometimes, well, I struggled, so you have to struggle too. Tessa's attitude is, I struggled and I'm going to make certain you don't have to do the same thing.
Yes.
I'm not going to screw you over, basically.
Right. Yeah. Man, three good movies.
Three very good movies. They're different, but the same too.
Yeah.
A lot of collaboration going on. I think that there's a collaborative element that runs through all three of these films, and the importance of particularly women collaborating with each other.
It's so true. So true.
And that's why the patriarchy tries to pit us against each other, everybody. They don't want us to get together.
Exactly. Because when we do, good things happen. We can't have good things.
And we gain power.
We gain power and use it for good. That's the thing. Like, we use it for good.
Mm-hmm. And we have to decide to do it. Like Tess, you have to make that decision. You have to decide that you're going to collaborate, that you're not going to simply, you know, take the power and run and not give the women that come behind you any sort of opportunity. Right. And those are choices that can be made, but we have to remember to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Amen, sister.
All right.
I think that's going to wrap things up for this week, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we would like to thank everyone for listening. Thank you all for joining us. And we would especially like to thank our patrons that help keep the show going. They are Abby, Ali, Brian, Connor, Estefania, Heather, James, Judy, Carriotta, Matt, Michelle, Monty, Nanina, Robert, Steve, Sharon, and Tao. If you would like to join them and become a patron too, you can go to patreon.com/citizendame and sign up. And there are other ways you can support us too. We've got our Ko-Fi, ko-fi.com/citizendame, and our Etsy shop, etsy.com/shop/citizendamepod. You can find us in other ways too. We do have our website, citizendamepod.com, where we occasionally post written reviews and other essays. And you can reach out to us by email, citizendamepod@gmail.com. And of course, we are on social media. We are on Twitter and Instagram, sort of Twitter, at Citizen Dame Pod. You can find us on Blue Sky, also at Citizen Dame Pod. And we are a Letterboxd HQ at Citizen Dame. And you can find us individually. Lauren, where are you?
I am on Instagram and Letterboxd at LH Business.
And I am at Karen M. Peterson. So that's going to wrap things up. Thank you all so much again for listening, and we will catch you next time.
Bye.
Here's to your mama, and here's to mine.
Thank you, darling. Darling.
Mama worked hard her entire life. She had 12 kids at 35. Woo! Working 24-7, 365. Working 5 to 9 and 9 to 5. They let you dream just to watch them shatter. You're just a step on the boss man's ladder. You got dreams you never take away.
Never take away.
You're